Podcast. I'm sure you all know, but I am your host, Nishad Carrington, and today I will be joined in voiceovers only by my beautiful fiance. So I want to tell her thank you from the beginning for lending her voice and her time to record those for me. I think it leads a bit of it lends itself well to the person and the topic that we're covering. Hopefully you all enjoy it. I'm sure her voiceovers are much better than mine. If you think so, write into us and let us know. If not, then I don't know that I'm going to be the one to pass that message. So feel free to send the messages along and I'll let her read them herself. I'm not passing that message to get myself in trouble. However, before we get started today, I just want to thank one of our sponsors for the show, Make Music Count. The mission of Make Music Count is to increase elementary and secondary students' mathematical skill development through piano playing and also reducing their math anxiety. By incorporating music into each lesson, students become engaged through music while simultaneously learning mathematical concepts. Each lesson is based on learning musical notes in a song. They are using songs of today, songs you hear on the radio. So look out for that. Now, each note is derived through a mathematical equation that varies from addition to subtraction to algebraic equations, and therefore solving math equations leads directly to playing the piano and a more positive attitude towards math. If you're an educator or responsible for student math and curriculum development, I encourage you to check out Make Music Count. You can find them at www.makemusiccount.com. Now back to our show. I think we have to actually establish a bit of a baseline and background for the very heavy topic that we're going to be discussing here today. And while this podcast series is all about the uplift and empowerment of the diaspora, there are times that I believe we'll have to mention some of the darker moments of our history as well. And that's primarily because even light can shine in the darkest and through the darkest of times. Now, while we champion the phrase here that our history didn't begin at slavery, there are some qualifying times that we must mention the bastion of chattel slavery to, you know, really to inform and educate of the progressive struggles that our people have made. And really today's episode and topic is no different. So in addition to abolishing slavery, the Emancipation Proclamation authorized the United States military to enlist African-American men as soldiers. Now, African-Americans had volunteered for duty in the Union Army prior to this time, but after the Emancipation Proclamation, the number of volunteers for military service increased exponentially. The Army assigned volunteers to segregated regiments whose members were collectively referred to as the United States Colored Troops, or the USCT. So you will hear me use those interchangeably throughout today's episode. I believe I'll probably more so use USCT so I don't have to say out the whole title. Now, approximately 175 regiments were formed and about 180,000 African-American soldiers actually fought for the Union Army. Now, more than a few African-American women may have served in the Union Army as well as it began forming regiments of all black men, but those are just assumptions and claims that are not easily verified. Now, by the war's end, the USCT comprised approximately 1/10 of all Union troops. And according to the National Park Service, the number of fatalities across the USCT regiments totaled about 68,178, with many of these men and potentially women dying from infection and disease. Now, in the South, while the men were off fighting, many upper-class women actually refused to lower themselves to working in hospitals, but many of them did open up their homes and their plantations to wounded soldiers and would nurse them in their homes. Now, a few Southern women, would actually put aside their distaste for hospitals and went to work. Now, I want you to bear in mind that the quote women we're referring to here are generally comprised of upper class white women of the time, and many of them themselves and their husbands actually being the landowning class in the South. Now, these people probably were likely hoping for a Southern victory and the continuation of the slave state South. But at the same time, lower class women of both black and white were not so fortunate to have this ability to choose between whether they want to open their home or, you know, refrain entirely or go to work in the hospital. Many of them spent hours and weeks and months and even years nursing patients and cleaning and preparing food in hospitals. Now, bear in mind again that nursing was not a woman's job before the Civil War. But by 1865, there were over 3,000 nurses serving the Union and the Confederacy. In the North, most women nurses worked in military hospitals. So many women actually ended up volunteering as union nurses that the United States government hired a lady by the name of Dorothea Dix to serve as the superintendent of women nurses. African-American nurses were not included in those numbers, nor were they recognized for their service for decades to come. Some were paid, but many and most of these women volunteered. Now, during the Civil War, Black women did serve as nurses, generally in convalescent homes and sometimes in U.S. government hospitals. The United States Navy also enlisted several African-American women as first-class boys, and of record, there were five of whom who actually served as nurses on the hospital ship USS Red Rover, their names being Alice Kennedy, Sarah Kenno, Ellen Campbell, Betsy Young, and Ann Bradford Stokes. We're going to get to Ann Bradford Stokes in just a second because she's probably the most famous of these women. African-American women, just as the men, saw the Civil War as an opportunity to fight oppression and end slavery. They also contributed to the war effort in various ways as organizers, activists, nurses, cooks, camp workers, and occasionally, as in the case with Harriet Tubman, as spies. They worked in hospitals in the North and in the South, and many of the nurses in the South were, in fact, African-American women. Now, undoubtedly, out of the five names I mentioned, plus the one who is our topic for today, there are very likely, highly likely, I would stake every dollar that's in my pocket that there are thousands of other names whom we will never know. So to them, I say thank you, and I'm sorry that we won't remember you. Now, as Union armies occupied Confederate states in the South, liberating more and more slaves, authorities began to employ these laborers for federal benefit. Government officials placed women, children, and men who were unfit for military service to work on abandoned plantations to raise cotton and food crops. Now, right there is an interesting piece of history that I want you to kind of ponder and think about. And, you know, please send us your thoughts and your feedback to this as well. It seems to me a little bit counterproductive and really ultimately hypocritical for the Union troops to be liberating slaves from the plantation and bondages of slavery, but then turning right back around and putting those unfit for war right back on the plantation in almost what amounts to a Union-sponsored version of slavery. Now, I fully understand the course of history and kind of the methods of production and labor, and so it may be true that much of the agricultural production for the nation and even the base materials for manufacturing were coming from the South at the time, and clearly the South had a large labor force that was slave labor. But the question I pose to you all, was it right for the Union Army to come in and essentially liberate to re-enslave? Let us know your thoughts. Feel free to visit us at our website, www.blackhistorypodcast.com or www.thisiscarrington.com. Contact us. Let us know your thoughts. You know, I'll be sure to read them on the future episode. So, as I said, Ann Bradford Stokes was probably the most famous of and best known of the African-American women who served as nurses on the Red Rover. The Red Rover was actually the first Union naval hospital ship. Bradford Stokes actually enlisted in the Navy in January of 1863 and served until October of 1864, during which time she was actually paid regular wages. Now, Stokes became the first African-American woman to serve on board a U.S. military vessel, and she was among the first women to serve as a nurse in the Navy. Nearly 3,000 patients were actually treated aboard the Red Rover during the Civil War, and Bradford Stokes worked under the direction of the Sisters of the Holy Cross nuns while she was aboard the ship. After leaving the Navy, Anne married Gilbert Stokes, and in 1890, Anne Bradford Stokes applied for a disability pension for her service during the Civil War and was certified by the Navy as having served on active duty for 18 months. She was awarded a pension that same year and is the first woman in the United States to receive a pension for her own military service. Anne Bradford Stokes unfortunately died in Illinois in 1903. Now, we're going to jump forward a little bit to actually talk about our topic for the day. Her name is Susie King Taylor. Remember that name, Susie King Taylor. Okay. So the majority of firsthand accounts of life in the colored regiments of the Civil War were written and published by white officers who led them. However, the details of only one Black Army woman's Civil War service is known due to a unique memoir that she left behind. Now, most of what is known about Susie King Taylor is actually derived from her memoir. It was called Reminiscences of My Life in Camp with the 33rd United States Colored Troops Late 1st South Carolina Volunteers. That title is a mouthful. However, the book is still available. You will be able to find a link to it on our website. Again, feel free to visit it. Leave us your comments and thoughts to this episode, as well as check out the book. Susie King Taylor, her memoir is a rare exception. With the encouragement of a white officer, Taylor actually published an account of her time with the 33rd Regiment USCT, and this volume is the only Civil War memoir that was published by an African-American woman. Again, the book is available. Anyone who wants to know more about Susie King Taylor, but also the battles of the Civil War, daily battle life for Black soldiers of the war, and really just more than anything else, a firsthand account of the war, I highly recommend that you pick up a copy and read it. Susie King Taylor is one of the great woman heroes of the 19th century, and some of her accomplishments include being the first African-American to become a school teacher, the first African-American to become an army nurse in the Civil War, and as we just discussed, she was the only African-American woman to publish a memoir of her wartime experiences. But I want you to just hang on to those thoughts right there, because we will get to all of those accomplishments in short order, and that is why she is our person for the week. Okay, so Susie King Taylor was born a slave, the first of nine children at Gress Farm, about 35 miles south of Savannah in Liberty County, Georgia, on August 6, 1848. Her mother was a domestic servant for the Gress family, and at about the age of five, she had mastered the skills of reading and writing. At about the age of seven, Susie King Taylor and her brother were sent to live with their grandmother named Dolly in Savannah. Now, Dolly is actually who Taylor would live for much of her childhood, and Dolly supported Taylor's education and actually sent her to an illegal school run by a freed African-American woman by the name of Miss Woodhouse. Now, Taylor and her brother and some other students had to hide their books and go in and out of the house one by one to avoid suspicion. And from Miss Woodhouse, she was able to gain the rudiments of literacy. And by 1860, having been taught everything that Miss Woodhouse could offer, Taylor then extended her education with the help of two white youths, a boy and a girl. We don't have their names, as history doesn't give them to us, but we do know they were white. We do know that they were young, a boy and a girl. Now, these two offered to teach her the lessons, even though they knew that it violated Georgia law and custom. Now, Taylor soon became a skilled reader and writer, and those abilities to read and write proved invaluable to the Union Army as they began to form regiments of African-American soldiers. Now, Taylor describes in her memoirs what it was like to have to pretend to not be going to school.
We went every day about 9 o'clock with our books wrapped in paper to prevent the police or white persons from seeing them. After school, we left the same way we entered, one by one. The neighbors would see us going in sometimes, but they supposed we were learning trades, as it was the custom to give children a trade of some kind.
Now, Susie King Taylor's education ended when she was forced to return to her mother on the Isle of Wight after her grandmother Dolly was arrested at a suburban church meeting for singing freedom hymns. There, Taylor can actually hear the Union soldiers firing on Fort Pulaski. 2 days after the fort was taken by Union forces, Susie King Taylor fled with her uncle and his family to St. Catherine Island, where they actually received Union protection and a transfer to the Union-occupied St. Simon Islands, where she claimed her freedom. Now, since most Blacks at the time were illiterate, it was soon discovered that Taylor could read and write. 5 days after her arrival, Commodore Lewis Goldsborough offered Taylor books and supplies if she would establish a school on the island. She accepted the offer and officially, again, became the first Black teacher to openly instruct African Americans in the state of Georgia. Now, we said she was the first Black teacher, but she was the first one to openly teach. It's not that she was the first, as we mentioned, obviously she had an illegal teacher, Miss Woodhouse, prior to, but she's the first to do it openly. Again, she became the first Black teacher for freed African-American students to work in a freely operated freedmen's school in Georgia. She taught 40 children in the day school and a number of adults who came to her at night. According to her, all of them so eager to learn to read and really to read above anything else. She would teach there until October of 1862, when the island was evacuated. She would meet and eventually marry Sergeant Edward King while she was teaching at St. Simon Island. And the two would actually move to Port Royal Island off of the coast of South Carolina. When Union officers raised the first South Carolina volunteers of African American soldiers, Taylor signed on as a nurse and soon started a school for black children and soldiers. Taylor would then serve for more than 3 years traveling with her husband's unit, the 33rd U.S. Colored Troops, as a doctor's aide, washing, cooking, and burning or burying of human limbs. Now, like most Civil War nurses, she did not go to school to learn to be a nurse. She learned on the job. And like many, if not most, African-American nurses, Taylor was never paid for her work as a nurse during the Civil War. So Taylor and many of the other nurses didn't have any actual traditional training in the medical field, which kind of jumps out at me because it's interesting is the fact that, you know, you're tossed into the foray of, again, she was burning or burying human limbs. She's being asked to care for gunshot wounds, disease and illness without training. You know, I have to question, you know, how likely would we be able to do that now if such a calamity would come about? You know, I'd have to guess that a certain level of folkloric medicine comes into play. I can promise you that my grandmother thinks you take Scott's emulsion for everything. If you have a cough, Scott's emulsion. Your elbow hurts, Scott's emulsion. Or you take a bath in Epsom salt and everything goes away. So I'd have to think that, especially during that time, there was a number of folkloric remedies for things. And maybe adrenaline kicks in at a certain point too. I don't know. Well, Taylor's experiences as a black employee of the Union Army are recounted in her memoirs as well. She describes numerous battles and intersperses these accounts with personal stories and commentary on life in the South, and especially the unequal treatment of the African-American soldiers.
The first colored troops did not receive any pay for 18 months, and the men had to depend wholly on what they received from the commissary. Their wives were obliged to support themselves and their children by washing for the officers and making cakes and pies, which they sold to the boys in the camp. Finally, in 1863, the government decided to give them half pay, but the men would accept none of this. They preferred rather to give their services to the state, which they did until 1864, when the government granted them full pay with all back due pay.
Now, though she was never paid for her services, Susie King Taylor wrote in her memoirs that she was very happy to know that her efforts were successful in the camp, and that she really felt the gratitude and appreciation of her service from the soldiers. Now, she gave her services for 4 years and 3 months without receiving a dollar, but was very happy to know that she was allowed to go along with the regiment and care for the sick and afflicted comrades. Now, when the volunteers actually left St. Simon Island, Taylor was again allowed to accompany them. She was initially taken on as a laundress, however, her duties very quickly expanded to include clerical work and nursing, and for the next few years, she assisted the troops as they traveled and battled their way throughout South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida. Taylor's experiences as a black employee of the Union Army are further recounted in her memoir.
Finally, orders were received for the boys to prepare to take Fort Greene. Each man to take 150 rounds of cartridges, canteens of water, hardtack, and salt beef. This order was sent 3 days prior to starting to allow them to be in readiness. I helped as many as I could to pack haversack and cartridge boxes. The fourth day, around 5 o'clock in the afternoon, the call was sounded and I heard the first sergeant say,
"Bombers firing!"
And they were no longer obeying the command. I went with them as far as the landing and watched them until they got out of sight. And then I returned to the camp. There was no one at camp but those left on a picket and a few disabled soldiers. And one woman, a friend of mine, Mary Shaw, and it was lonesome and sad. Now that the boys were gone, some never to return. About 4 o'clock, July 2nd, the charge was made. The firing could be plainly heard in camp. I hastened down to the landing and remained there until 8 o'clock that morning. When the wounded arrived, or rather began to arrive, the first one brought in was Samuel Anderson of our company. He was badly wounded. Then others of our boys, some with their legs off, arm gone, foot off, and wounds of all kinds imaginable. They had to wade through creeks and marshes, as they were discovered by the enemy and shelled very badly. My work there began. I gave my assistance to try to alleviate their sufferings. I asked the doctor at the hospital what I could get them to eat. They wanted soup, but that I could not get. I had a few cans of condensed milk and some turtle eggs, so I thought I would try to make some custard. I had doubts as to my success, for cooking with turtle eggs was something new to me. But the result was very delicious custard. This I carried to the men who enjoyed it very much. My services were given at all times for the comfort of these men. I was on hand to assist whenever needed. I was enrolled as company laundress, but I did very little of it because I was always busy doing other things through camp and was employed all the time doing something for the officers and comrades.
Now, she also tells of a smallpox outbreak and white deserters from the Confederate Army who joined the Union soldiers because they had no Negroes to fight for. And actually the fun that the regiment had with a well-trained pig who eventually learned to march out with them and kept perfect time with their music. Taylor also recounts the glorious day of the public reading of the Emancipation Proclamation. Now, as we discussed before, she had no formal medical training or nursing training, so in treating soldiers, she used a combination of traditional and folk remedies that she had been taught. Now, after caring for patients with smallpox, she maintained that sassafras tea is actually what kept her healthy and kept her from getting smallpox. Susie often went to the hospital for African-American soldiers at Beaumont, South Carolina. And while she was there, she met and worked with Clara Barton. Now, for any of you who don't know, Clara Barton was actually the Civil War nurse who later went on to found the American Red Cross. In her memoirs, Susie would say that she was grateful that her efforts were appreciated, and again will state, for 4 years and 3 months, she served without any pay of any kind. Now, right here, it might be just a little bit necessary to give a bit of perspective to the history and background of the 33rd Regiment. Now, I'm sure many of you have heard of the 54th Regiment that was featured in the movie Glory that earned Denzel Washington numerous awards, including Best Supporting Actor at the Oscars. Now, side note, please trust that we will dedicate a full episode to the 54th Regiment later, as that group is more than deserving. But the 33rd was a different group, and as we mentioned before, there were about 175 all-black regiments that were formed during the Civil War, with about 180,000 African-Americans enlisted in the Army. But before we do this, we're going to take a word from our sponsor, Make Music Count, just to remind you who's bringing us these episodes. The mission of Make Music Count is to increase elementary and secondary students' mathematical skill development through piano playing while also reducing their math anxiety. By incorporating music into each lesson, students become engaged through music while simultaneously learning mathematical concepts. Each lesson is based on learning musical notes in a song. Each note is derived through a mathematical equation that varies from addition and subtraction all the way up to algebraic equations. Therefore, solving math equations leads directly to playing the piano and a much more positive attitude towards math. If you're in youth development or a teacher and you're struggling with your students learning math, don't be afraid to check out our friends at MakeMusicCount.com. Now back to the show. Captain Charles Towbridge would arrive at St. Simon Island to gather troops for what would become the 33rd Regiment of the 1st South Carolina Volunteers. Department of the South Staff Officer James D. Fessenden was also heavily involved in efforts to recruit potential volunteers. Now, this group was composed primarily of escaped slaves from South Carolina and Florida, and with most of these ex-slaves coming from St. Augustine and St. John's counties. Now, there had been previous attempts to form black units in New Orleans and Kansas, but they were not officially recognized. Now, although it saw some combat, the regiment was not involved in any of the war's major battles. Its first commander was Thomas Wentworth Higginson, who was, as were all other officers, white. Now, a huge part of the reason for a limited combat was due to the fact that though in July 1862, Congress passed a law permitting black men to enlist at a pay rate of $10 a month, which it was actually $3 less than the pay rate of a white private, Congress left it up to the president to determine the duties of the black volunteers. Now, while we look at Lincoln as being this great emancipator, Lincoln also decided that any blacks enlisting into the army were to be used only as laborers and were not to be trained as combat soldiers. I would have to think that's probably because Lincoln had the thought in mind that if we train these individuals how to use a gun, if we train them how to formulate into a proper regiment, that may come back to bite us. It probably would have. All of this organization had been done before approval from Lincoln, and the 1st South Carolina Volunteers were eventually abandoned. Now, on August 10th, the regiment was dissolved except for Company A. In November of 1862, the 33rd was reconstituted under Colonel Thomas Wentworth Higginson, and the regiment consisted of 10 companies of about 86 men each. And on January 1st, 1863, at the Camp Saxton Emancipation Proclamation celebration, the regimental colors were given to the 33rd Regiment. the troops were official and paid. A proclamation by Confederate President Jefferson Davis had actually indicated that members of the regiment would not be treated as prisoners of war if taken in battle. And according to Jefferson Davis, any captured enlisted men would be auctioned off as slaves and the white officers would be hung. Now, that threat was never carried out officially, and though never reported, I'm sure there probably were some instances that were underreported of Confederate soldiers engaged in this exact and very behavior. The regiment was a step in the evolution of Union thinking towards the fact that escaped slaves who had crossed their lines. Initially, they were returned to their owners. Next, they were considered contraband and used as laborers. Finally, the legal fiction that they were property was abandoned and they were allowed to enlist in the army, although in segregated units commanded by white officers. In fact, as we mentioned earlier, Harriet Tubman served with these men as a cook, nurse, spy, and a scout. The men of this group would serve as the precedent for over 180,000 black troops who followed them into the Union Army. Now, to find out more information regarding the 33rd and many other regiments in the Civil War, there is a great online resource for information regarding the regiment and these men and commanders. The website is called Dr. Bronson Tours. This is not an endorsement for the website, as we have not been in contact with them, nor they to us, but as this was just a great researched index, I did feel it was necessary to provide their information out. They go as far in their research to even provide information about each of the people in these regiments, down to their height, their ages, and their cause of death if it occurred in battle. Now, you should really take a look at this because it's really kind of interesting to see, but you might be surprised at just how short most of these men were. I am only 5'10 on a good day, and I probably would have been towering over most of the 33rd Regiment. These were the first African-American soldiers in the Union Army, and they continued to serve until they were disbanded on January 31st, 1866. Now, we'll get back to Susie King Taylor now, but I do encourage you to look up that information on the 33rd and the other groups fighting. It's proclaimed that many wars are wars for freedom, but there's really and truly no better distinction of this than the USCTs and the men fighting in these regiments. I mean, this was truly a battle for their lives. As to be captured in battle, they would have possibly been sold back into slavery. To lose a battle would mean to possibly be killed. And really, worst of all, to lose the war would mean that slavery would continue not just for them, but possibly even the present day. A great deal of gratitude is owed to these men, their sacrifice, and their accomplishments. Now, following the Civil War, Susie King Taylor established a school for freed slaves. She and her husband settled into Savannah, Georgia. Despite her husband's expertise as a carpenter, he was unable to find work because of his race, so he worked at a pier unloading ships. And though Taylor offers few details in her memoir about King's death in 1866, scholars have noted that he died in a work-related accident at the pier just a few months before their son's birth, which is a shame. Now, around the time of her husband's death, she's also forced to close her school when a free school opens up nearby. And Taylor's repeated attempts to establish and maintain other schools actually kind of end in much of the same way. And in order for her to support herself and her son, she takes on various positions as a domestic servant, forcing her to leave her son with her mother in the South. By the early 1870s, Taylor had moved to Boston as a domestic servant of a white family, where she actually met her second husband, Russell Taylor, the two of them being married in 1879. But it's not really known whether or not the second marriage produced any children. What's interesting to note is that throughout this episode, I've been referring to her as Susie King Taylor, meaning she kept both of her married names, King and Taylor. Susie King Taylor also served as president of the Women's Relief Corps in 1893. Previously, she had served as a guard, secretary, and treasurer of the same. The Women's Relief Corps was an organization whose purpose was to give assistance to soldiers in hospitals, and during the Spanish-American War, she furnished and packed boxes for wounded men in hospitals. In 1890, after a trip to care for her dying son in Louisiana, Taylor actually wrote her memoirs, which she privately published them as a book in 1902 as Reminiscences of My Life in Camp with the 33rd U.S. Colored Troops. Taylor spent much of the remainder of her life in the North serving as a teacher, a domestic servant, and a cook. Now, Susie Baker King Taylor died in relative obscurity in 1912 at the age of 64 in Boston. She's actually buried next to her second husband at Mount Hope Cemetery in Roslindale, Massachusetts. Roslindale, in case you don't know, is one of the suburbs of the city of Boston, not too far away from Dorchester and Roxbury, and Mattapan too. Taylor's memoir ends with her, quote, thoughts on present conditions and a description of the death of her son. She actually rails against still prevalent racism, observing the following.
We cannot sing, my country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, and it's a hollow mockery.
And while she finds hope in the North, she actually condemns much of the South. And while traveling to Shreveport, Louisiana to retrieve her dying son, she is forced to ride on a car for colored people and is harassed by constables because of her race. And she actually ends up seeing a hanged African-American man. And unable to secure a sleeper berth because of her race, she cannot fulfill her son's wish to die at home. She remains in Shreveport with her son, but admits,
it seemed very hard when his father fought to protect the Union and our flag, and yet his boy was denied, under the same flag, a birth to carry him home to die because he was a Negro.
Now, the way Susie King Taylor actually closes out her memoir is with both hope and with a demand. You know, what she went through in life didn't change how she felt about the hope for the future. And she closes it out this way.
My people are striving to attain the full standard of all other races born free in the sight of God, and in a number of instances have succeeded. Just as we ask to be citizens of these United States, where so many of our people have shed their blood with their white comrades, that the stars and stripes should never be polluted.
Now, Susie King Taylor really left a legacy of hard work and devotion to duty, no matter what the circumstances. She did not judge people by their color, but by their actions, and expected others to do the same. She truly deserves to be included in the prestigious lists of famous nurses because of the impact she had on so many lives, obviously not only in the Civil War, but also in the Spanish-American War. Now, I want to thank again my fiance for providing her voice for the voiceovers. I don't know that I could have given Susie King Taylor's legacy its just due with my terrible voiceovers that I'm sure you all have grown tired of hearing at this point. But I do want to thank her very much for her contribution to this episode. Now, again, thank you very much. And in closing, on behalf of myself and the rest of our staff here at the Black History Podcast, thank you for listening to our information, our banter, and we hope that you pick something up from us, especially in this episode. I'm sure this won't be the last time you'll hear voiceovers from someone other than myself, and definitely not contributions from others. Again, as always, in closing, please be sure to check us out every week for new and updated topics. In the event you have any questions or general commentary about this episode, please feel free to visit our website at www.blackhistorypodcast.com or www.thisiscarrington.com/podcast. Or you can just navigate to the podcast tab at the top of the page. Now, as we develop and grow, you will find an archive of each episode, plans for our future episodes, as well as additional links to books and resources that will help you in the journey to self-enlightenment. We encourage you to share episodes with everybody, your friends, your family, your children, your cousins. You know the deal. We just encourage you to share our history and episodes with everyone. Send us your feedback as well. Suggest new topics, events, or people we should cover. Or if you just wish to drop us a line and give us your thoughts or perspectives to an episode we've done, we will make every best effort to include listener mail or commentary to future episodes. Now, please, as we take this journey together, remember that we will do our best to present the diaspora in the most objective light, with some occasional commentary presented. But if you were to come across any errors or mistakes, please let us know. Because as we like to say here, only steel can sharpen steel. Take care, and we'll see you next week.